Hello everyone and welcome to the first oneliner.com podcast of 2011. I am Craig Eastman, just as I was last year. No surprise there. And also imitating themselves, but now in another year. Our Scott Morris.
Hello.
Andrew Tamendale.
How do?
We've all probably just about recovered from heavy drinking sessions over the past couple of weeks, so let us crack on. Before we crack on with any type of pretense at review, I would just take this moment to say farewell to the great potato-faced Pete Postlethwaite, who sadly...
Ugly bloke, wasn't he?
No. Pete Postlethwaite, who was a fine actor, and by all accounts, a fine man, and will be sadly missed. Does anyone have a particular favourite Pete Postlethwaite film? I'd plump for the Usual Suspects.
I'd go for, yeah.
My favourite performance from him came in Aeon Flux, where he had an outflip where he made him look like the top half of a fajita, which was a high point, I think, in his career.
Bless him. On a serious note, it was a proper downer to turn on the news this morning and see that he had sadly passed away. I didn't realise he was actually, he had cancer. So, there you go. That put me off my toast this morning. Fare thee well, Pete, wherever you may be. And thanks for the, let's face it, ridiculous accent in The Usual Suspects, but a great performance nonetheless. Thanks for chipping in there, lads, with your heartfelt comments. That was just me calling a dead man potato-faced and then trying to rapidly backpedal onwards and upwards. The Kids Are All Right has garnered quite a bit of praise on the awards circuit. Directed by Lisa Cholodenko of Laurel Canyon fame, and with an excellent cast including Annette Bening, Julianne Moore and Mark Ruffalo, it's the tale of two artificially conceived children who, having grown up, decide to invite their biological father to be part of their lives. Knowing nothing other than this, I can see this one going one way or the other. Scott, is it a waxer or a waner?
Wax on, wax off. I enjoyed The Kids Are Alright an awful lot. It is perhaps ironically about as left-wing a film as you can imagine. The kids are looking for their biological father, who's played by Mark Ruffalo, who is seemingly a successful restaurateur, but he's shirking from personal commitment and he's basically a bit of a self-involved asshat. However, he's charmed enough by the kids to sort of take on a bit more of a parental role, much to the mothers of Julianne Moore and Annette Bening's distaste, who didn't want him anywhere near, think he's a bad influence. Turns out to become a bit of a strain. There's already some tensions in the relationship between the two mothers. It gets a lot worse when Ruffalo's character embarks on an affair with Julianne Moore's character. From when you start talking about it in these kind of terms, it's starting to sound an awful lot like it's a lot more drama than it is comedy, but it is actually a comedy drama. It's very well balanced. It is pretty funny throughout. The drama that's in there doesn't feel particularly forced. It's quite believable. The characterisation's solid. They all feel like they could well be real characters. There's no histrionic screeching or anything along those lines. It's all pretty realistic and quite enjoyable. It is a great ensemble performance from the cast, as you probably would expect given the characters involved. There's amusing situations and the believable characters make it well worthy of the buzz it's gathering. Don't really see that I need to go into much more detail of that, partly because I saw this film almost 2 months ago and can't remember a lot more of it than that, but I enjoyed it an awful lot. I think it's well worth a watch and is definitely worth the actress nominations, the best actress nominations it's getting in award ceremonies up and down the country.
Drew, did you get a chance to pick this one up?
No.
Bummer. Obviously, I haven't seen The Kids Are Alright, but normally I would have no interest whatsoever in this film, but based on your recommendation, Scott, and the fact that it contains my favourite of all favourites, Julianne Moore, and also Mark Ruffalo, who I don't think I've ever seen be anything less than great in anything he's ever been in. I might actually hunt this down.
Yeah, it's a really difficult film to synopsise without it sounding kind of, I don't know, French.
Bland.
It's got that sort of kind of French thing with all these little personal relationship pseudo-comedy slight farces.
Yeah, bizarrely enough, I know what you mean by that.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I don't think I've ever seen a French comedy that I've actually liked, but this is actually well handled and it's very funny and it's a great cast performances, so it's well worth looking.
It seems to be informed by continental European melodrama, yet retains the accessibility of the American studio system.
Yes, mainly it's accessible because it's in English, I think is what they mean by that.
Ah, okay. Does anything blow up in it? Do cars blow up?
Only your preconceptions.
Nice. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 then, or as I shall henceforth refer to it, the one the Indian CG hack factories couldn't get converted to 3D in time, is the penultimate episode in the Harry Potter saga, having been split in two.
I shall set my effortlessly predictable cynicism aside and allow Drew to field this one. Drew, give us a rundown, if you're one of the six people in the world now, because it used to be seven, but obviously I've caught up, who haven't seen a Harry Potter film. What is going on?
Well, there's this kid, right, who's a wizard, and he's called Harry Potter, right?
With you so far.
And where wizard and hero Harry Potter is being chased by the big bad boogeyman Voldemort and is chasing around the country trying to find out how to kill him, basically, because he's super invincible, top level boss fella. And well, that's basically the plot, is he's trying to find out ways to kill him, at the same time dealing with relationship issues, etc. There's not, you're either going to know the rest of it or not care, probably, but that's it in a nutshell.
and what a concise little nutshell it was. for my tuppence worth, I have to say actually that the sort of I was quite entertained and I was quite drawn in by about the first half hour of this film. It was actually, I don't know what I was expecting. I think based on the last one, I didn't have high hopes. The last one was certainly on celluloid and being projected on a screen, but there wasn't much happening in it to keep me entertained. The first half hour of this is actually a proper film, and I was quite engrossed in it. Probably up until the point where Hermione tried to run away from a snake and was ambushed by a pile of books. And from that point on, I kind of lost most of my interest in it. But then I'm not the world's biggest Harry Potter fan. Scott, where does it sit in the Harry Potter canon for you?
Well, this is another one from director David Yates, who did the last two outings, and I've not really liked most of those films. I would think this is perhaps the best of the Harry Potters so far. It's helped in no small part by the fact that the not-so-young now leads have matured enough to actually be, you know, actors, and so for once you actually get drama and emotion, which has really been a sticking point with the entire series. It didn't feel like anyone believed what was going on. I think now they actually do. You get a pretty good feeling from these characters now. I was quite entertained throughout, to be honest. Especially surprised me a little bit, given that a lot of it seems to be Harry Potter goes camping. There's an awful lot of sitting around woods, and I figured that bit, you know, maybe that goes on too long. Maybe it doesn't. I think it's important for the character development, but there's a part of you that keeps thinking that it should be moving on a bit faster. But no, actually, other than perhaps that, I really enjoyed it, and I don't have anything particularly bad to say about it. The CG's halfway decent. It's certainly got better than it has been. It's certainly a lot better. ITV, I think, showed the first film over holidays that I happened to see most of when it was on the telly, and to say the series has come a long way would be damning it with faint praise. It really has come on leaps and bounds. This is actually a pretty good film. I quite enjoyed this, and I'm actually quite looking forward to the next one. The bone I've got to pick with it is it does end halfway through, but not much you can do about that. I'm actually genuinely looking forward to the next one.
I'm almost looking forward to the next part, actually.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed it as well, and the other films I'd never really liked any of them, and while I had big problems the last two, I thought they're perhaps better than some others in the series, but I was always comparing Harry Potter films before now with other Harry Potter films, whereas this one I think is a genuinely good film as a film, not just compared to something else in the same series. And yeah, the acting has come on, particularly Daniel Radcliffe, who, if you've ever seen him interviewed, seems such a nice guy, but he was such a terrible actor. And he really has matured a lot, and it's good for him, and it makes the film better. I probably had the same reservation with Scott, that the whole camping thing went on a little too long. And in previous films, it's been a bit of a bugbear of mine that what should be action set pieces, and they are there in the book, have kind of been tossed aside, leaving all sort of action out of the film, as in the last film, they invent a bit in the middle of it for some reason. Whereas in this film, they do actually use some action set pieces, including one right at the start, just to get you going, although I did feel perhaps they could have made more of that, even a couple minutes longer.
Yeah, let's make it a bit more
set piece to start off with.
Let's make it a bit more John Woo with wands.
Other than that, yeah, I thought it was really quite good. And there's something that happens to a character, and I know that you thought the character's a bit annoying, and the character is annoying. But what happens to that carp actually, for the first time in the whole series, allows the characters to show actual emotion.
Well, it's not the first time that they have the opportunity to show it. It's the first time it's probably seized upon, from what
I'm saying. Yeah. They actually have the chance to have emotion, and I never understood why it wasn't there before. For instance, in the last film, you have your main fighter, your big champion in this war against darkness, dying, and everybody more or less goes,
oh no,
he's dead then. Oh well, back on the train.
He would me a fiver.
Which I never quite understood why you think they should be absolutely destroyed. Even if not for the fact that this person was somebody they loved and thought a friend, certainly for their own survival, they're thinking, well, perhaps we're doomed now. And they're just, the whole film was so flat. This film doesn't seem to suffer from that problem. It allows the characters to actually have some emotion and have some impact of a friend's death. And also, they managed to have gotten over the problem of it making it seem like time had actually passed at all in this film. Something in the fifth film was particularly guilty of, when it could have easily happened in a week and a half.
You have to say that the scene at the end of this one, which you're referring to, is the only thing which awoke me from my slumber, having lost interest completely in the huge middle tract. And it's probably possibly my favourite scene in the whole film, because a simpering little dick gets knifed. That's all I have to say about that.
One thing I really liked in this was the little animation that they produced for the Deathly Hallows little nursery rhyme kind of thing. That was really quite well done. I quite enjoyed that. That was one of the highlights in the film. But
the little story, yeah. It was, I can see why people might think that sort of it didn't fit in, but I liked it, certainly. I think it looked quite nice, but I'm not sure how else you would do that. Otherwise, you'd just be staring at people being told a story, I guess, so.
Yeah, I don't feel bother about it. I don't think it was the most fantastically inventive animation sequence ever, but it did a job, I suppose. Like I say, it's preferable to just sitting watching Reese Iphens gurning away. Well, it wasn't Reese Iphens telling the story, though, was it? So that makes me an idiot. It was Hermione. But yeah, it was still preferable to watching Reese Iphens gurning. I suppose the plot would have made far less sense if it suddenly just cut to 5 minutes of him going,
Man, you're going to hate the next film. There's a whole chapter at the end of that film that's just him gurning away. It's not even his character in the book, it's actually Reese Iphens.
I'm going to hate the next film because it's not going to live up to my wants. Because I know for a fact the next film doesn't deliver on the promise that the book made, which it's going to be a massacre, everyone will die, but we all know that everybody doesn't. So, shut it, rolling.
You're never happy unless everybody dies.
In these films, I've seen two now, and two people have died. One of them was a old beardy git, and the other one, like I say, is a stupid little bell end who insists on referring to himself in the third person the whole time. Well, right, you're marked for death straight away, pal. Bloody hated him. Honestly, this is the first I'd actually seen him, and I immediately despised him. So
you have no tolerance for hipster elves, do you?
Good on Helena Bonham Carter, that's all I can say. She's redeemed herself after bloody Alice in Wonderland for those darts playing skills. On to Chronicles of Narnia, Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I watched part of a Narnia film the other day on television with the sound down. The couple of minutes I saw involved a badger talking to a dwarf, which is something I am simply not willing to accept. It only got worse when, in a pseudo-medieval fantasy world, one of the characters pulled out a battery-powered torch. In view of this, I ask Scott to fill you in on the plot of the third film in what is now officially my most despised children's franchise.
Well, the Narnia franchise is just more stumbling on than continuing with the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which sees Prince Caspian returning as the young Pevensies, Lucy and Edmund, return to Narnia for another hijinks-filled adventure, yada yada yada. This time they also pull their obnoxious cousin Eustace, who is played by Son of Rambo's Will Poulter, and if you've not seen Son of Rambo, go and see Son of Rambo, it's very good. This time they're facing off against an evil mist that has been bothering the populace. With such a well-defined villain, it's little wonder. this appears to be a deviation from the book that was apparently required to fit it into some kind of structure. I don't think it is myself. It's really an excuse to try and shoehorn again, for some fucking reason, Tilda Swinton's White Witch.
Oh, she's not back in it. It was ridiculous enough when she was in the second film, artificially.
I don't know why I've done it. Nothing like as compelling a character as the producers seem to think that she is. It's really not required in the slightest. Don't know what it's doing there. It just sort of, and it's never really much of a threat. It just, this whole idea is kind of just sits alongside the main quest, which is Prince Caspian trying to track down these seven lords who went missing a while back and is on about to find them and all that kind of thing, which is a perfectly suitable narrative framework. And I don't know what the hell this, apparently it's some kind of element from The Silver Chair, which I can't really comment on one or the other because I don't think I've read that one. This film, however, well, it's solid enough, I suppose. It's another one of these post-production converts to 3D. Thankfully, they've had a bit more time to do it than, say, Clash of the Titans, so it's not quite as shonky.
It's not a pop-up.
No, it's not quite as bad, but it's no better or worse than any other 3D film you'll see. But it really adds nothing to the film again. It's just there. It's in 3D just to try and hook people in, which does not seem to have had great success in doing. Well, the CG effects in general are probably a bit more polished here than they have been in the previous outings, which were, you know, kind of ropey. So I think that may be because they've kind of toned back on the number of silly mythological animals hoofing about the place, so there's a bit less to go wrong. There's nothing terrible in this playthrough. It's a solidly enough produced film. It's competent. It's far less rough around the edges than Prince Caspian was, but probably in part because of that, it's also a far less interesting film. There's no real interesting thematic developments here. It's just a bunch of stuff that happens. The characters don't really have any particular journey apart from the kind of comically obnoxious cousin becoming, you know, magically better at the end thanks to the presence of the Jesus lion, Aslan. I was a bit annoyed by the more, but straight out of the book, so I can't really be that annoyed by it. I knew what I was signing up for, but the whole kind of, you know, Christian lion thing, I don't know what the, I don't really understand what the point of that was. There's a line towards the end of the film that says Aslan had pulled these two Pevensey kids in, saying that, well, okay, I'm Jesus in your world, and I pulled you here so you may know me better in your world. Like, that's a very elaborate way to convert two kids to a Christian cause. There's not a good value for money proposition in that. I'm sure they could come up with something
that's
better.
That's more fun than just going to Sunday school, though, isn't it?
That is true.
Yeah, but it's not exactly converting the masses, is it?
No.
It's a pretty time-consuming and inefficient way to go about it.
I guess God must get bored after all this infinity time. So I know, Narnia, that'll work for two kids. Yeah, but the film itself, it's fine. I'm sure it will keep your kids happy, but there's nothing particularly interesting in there. It's perhaps the most competently produced of all the Narnia ones, but it's also one of the dullest, which is perhaps a strange contradiction, but that's how it plays out. It's just not that interesting. Not highly recommended at all.
Yeah, true.
What he said.
Yeah. Competently produced, other than the decision to convert to 3D, presumably.
Well, it's the 3D is fine. The 3D is not really an issue with it. It's no better or worse than most 3D films you'll see, even the ones that are, you know, presumably from the outset intended to be 3D. They've been working at it for 9 months. It's not like the 3 weeks that they had to do for Clash of the Titans. It looks decent enough, but yeah, it's just not very interesting.
What's the state of play at the moment? Are we still, because I haven't been to see anything in 3D for a long time, are we still paying extra to go and see 3D films?
Yep.
Right, okay, so the 3D conversion being fine still isn't good enough then?
No,
basically. That's the bottom line. I just wish they would get over this nonsense. So,
yeah.
But there you go. Having said that, I've not been to see Tron yet, believe it or not. Oh, Tron.
Oh, no.
I knew you were going to say that, you dick.
You know how great my love is for the original.
I know. It's surprising we were ever friends. Adapted from the novel A Very Quiet Gentleman, the American is Anton Corbijn's second foray into directing and sits in stark contrast to his previous effort, The Excellent Control. In it, George Clooney is a reclusive gunsmith for hire who is forced to lay low in a picturesque Italian mountainside village after someone decides to come gunning for him. So far, so cliched. And if that premise doesn't suit, then consider that he also befriends a hooker and a priest. Do we think he may learn some lessons about life from those two? Now throw in a one last job, and you'd be forgiven for throwing in the towel. Stick with it, though, and The American is a surprisingly sedately paced thriller with some good turns, and the cinematography you'd expect from one of the world's finest photographers working among some of Europe's most scenic countryside. Scott, colours of Day of the Jackal here. What did you make of The American?
Well, sedately paced is very much the key word for this. It is glacially paced. It is fact.
It's almost testing the boundaries of what you could consider to be a thriller.
It's testing what you could consider pacing. Nothing happens. Nothing happens at any pace. I don't mind the occasional kind of minimalist narrative, but just nothing here for it. I get that the whole point of it is that, you know, Clooney being a these kind of assassin kind of gunsmith person, he's got to be kind of plays cards close to his chest, and the more he starts opening up and the more he kind of tries to enter a real life, the more he puts himself in danger, and that's why it's just, you know, he's kind of quiet at the start and yada yada yada. But it just doesn't make for particularly interesting watching. It kind of coasts by for a while on Corbyn's cinematographic efforts. It's very pretty. It's a great looking film. Looks fantastic. Looks lovely. But that only lasts for maybe, half an hour, 40 minutes, and you start to notice that there's not really anything going on here. Much as I like Clooney, he's just not got anything to work with. You don't really get much of, well, at least I didn't get any real feeling of his character or what he's going through. I get the impression this might work really well as a book, but it's just not a film experience. It's just not the sort of thing that should have been attempted as a film. Pretty, but pretty empty.
I quite liked it because of its sort of bizarrely mind-numbing hypnotic pace. Kind of in spite of itself, I couldn't help but like it, but it is pushing the boundaries of, I suppose, what could be considered a cinematic experience. It's got a big problem in that it opens with a fantastic scene which kind of...
Oh, there may be some action in this film. Oh, wait, no.
Yeah, but no, not only that, but it's actually, there's quite a shocking moment in it, and it kind of sets those cards out on the table, and you think to yourself, damn, this is... Mm-hmm. This could be quite twisted, this could be quite interesting. And it finishes with a nice little... It finishes on a fantastic turn. I thought it finished sort of perfectly, but there is this huge swathe in the middle, punctuated only by like a little five-minute chase, which isn't even a car chase. Two vehicles, one of them's a scooter. Right, one of them's a Vespa. So you know you can only push so much high-octane action out of that. I don't know. I think it would like to think that it's this kind of methodically paced look at this man's workmanlike, the sort of his craft and whatnot, but actually there's not a lot of that in it, and the rest that you have to rely on is unfortunately just a pile of cliches. Like I say, kind of in spite of itself, I still did kind of enjoy it, but I wouldn't expect many other people to share that sentiment. It's just one of these films that falls into, I mean, we've all got a personal sort of work category, and I suppose it kind of falls into mine. I did quite enjoy it, but I wouldn't really expect anyone else to have quite as enjoyable an experience. It sets out quite an exciting stall, and well, fails to knock the coconuts over, unfortunately.
You're going to have a pretty high tolerance for fairly slow-paced minimalist films or dramas for this kind of thing. It just doesn't fit well into any kind of category at all, so you can't really say if you love thrillers you'll love this, because you probably won't, or if you loved drama, you'll love this because it's not. If you love character pieces, you'll love this because there's probably not enough. It's one of these strange little ones where I don't know quite where the intersection of the Venn diagram is for the audience for this film. If you're in it, fantastic, but I think that's a very small subsection of an audience.
I'm actually quite curious to read the book now to see how much it borrows from Frederick Forsyth's Day of the Jackal, because the film seems to be borrowing a lot from Day of the Jackal, and I think it would like to think that it's taken some of the good elements from that, but it's almost as if they've said, do you know what? George, we can't have George Clooney be a bad guy, so you don't, other than like the opening couple of minutes, you don't get any of that stuff that Edward Fox pulled off in Day of the Jackal, where, you know, you've got that terrible scene where essentially, you know, he seduces a woman and goes and stays with her for a few days and then murders her pretty much just to get her car. Things like that. We can't have George Clooney do that. So there's nothing, it's just him sort of moping about this beautiful little town. It's made me want to go
to Italy,
because I'm in love with Italy anyway, and I'm thinking to myself, well, I'd love to go to Castel Del Monte now, but unfortunately that's not a brilliant filmic experience. There's none of the tension that there was in Day of the Jackal, the enjoyment of like watching this guy methodically planning something, because he's not really methodically planning anything. He's just the guy who makes the guns, essentially. He's Who played the gunmaker in Day of the Jackal? It was Cyril someone, wasn't it?
Cyril Smith?
It might have been.
It might have been.
Cyril Cusack. Essentially, he's just Cyril Cusack's character in Day of the Jackal, getting into a bit of bother, and that's not as much fun. So, yeah.
It's annoying for these kind of films, though. I cannot possibly recommend it to anyone, but at the same time, I can appreciate the amount of work that's gone into it in making something like this.
Yeah, and they've tried to do something different, bless them.
Yeah, it's just sad that for me, certainly, it just didn't work at all. I found it very dull.
I think, like you say, if you've got quite a high tolerance for slow pacing, then you might get more out of it. But certainly don't go and see it on the strength of the trailer, which kind of promises some sort of crazy action hitman thriller, which is the furthest thing from the truth you can possibly imagine. The Tourist. Drew, have you seen The Tourist?
I have.
You have. Would you like do something other than or more than I have prepared for the tourist? For I have prepared nothing.
Nor have I, but I'll give it a go.
You have the advantage of at least having seen it.
Yes, for it is a last fresh in my mind.
Yay!
So, yes then, the tourist. Angelina Jolie's taste filters are partly having failed of late. She's followed up the magnificently stupid Salt with the almost as magnificently stupid The Tourist. She's the former lover, still lover, but hasn't seen, been abandoned, not quite sure what the relationship really is here. We'll settle for former lover of this former banker to a gangster and business tycoon who stole all his money and disappeared and is now being hunted down by Interpol. She is given instructions to meet him in Venice, and to cover her meeting with him, she sits down to this poor dupe, Frank, a maths teacher from the backwoods in America, played by Johnny Depp in a silly beard. Her job then is to persuade the authorities that he's the man they're looking for, so she can go and have the heat taken off her and go and meet him for real. A bunch of stupid shit happens, and it ends not soon enough. Yep, that's it. Pish.
Brilliant. Scott?
I'll pretty much agree with that. It's pish.
Nice.
Next film.
There's just not much to say about it. It's just a bunch of excruciatingly signposts, unbelievable twists. It's just stupid all the way throughout. The only thing I liked in it was Timothy Dalton, who does a nice little supporting role, but that's like three lines. But they're three very well-delivered lines, and you take what you can get in this film.
Yeah. It's something Scott mentioned, actually, whether he thought it's meant to be kind of a spoof on sort of old spy films or something.
Mm.
Like kind of studio-based stuff, because there's a couple of shots, like one of Johnny Depp running across the rooftops. It's really, really clearly green-screened.
Yeah.
And another shot where he's supposed to be getting pulled behind a motorboat up the canals of Venice, where he's quite clearly in an outdoor tank with water being pumped to him. It doesn't look even slightly like he's being pulled through water. He's clearly stationary with water being shoved at him. And it's a couple of like really artless things like that that, I mean, they stand out so glaringly. You've got to wonder, is there something deliberate in that? And if there is, it's stupid. it's just really bad filmmaking. And then there's other things too. It doesn't seem to have settled on a tone. There's not enough silly stuff for it to be spoof, wouldn't be quite the word, I think, or perhaps tongue-in-cheek. It's a gentle parody, perhaps, of some of those films.
Yeah.
But it's not enough of it to be like that, or it's just a really bad script or a really badly misjudged tone. For instance, they have things like, for some reason, Johnny Depp, despite being, he's a maths teacher, so presumably not completely stupid, you would hope, right? And he travels to Venice, but keeps trying to speak Spanish for some reason. And then is on the phone to the concierge at his hotel and says Bon Jovi instead of Buongiorno. There's loads of daft things like that.
I actually
not
quite
enough...
want to see this now.
Oh, you don't trust me. It also has Stephen Berkoff in it, but not being as soon as Stephen Berkoff turns up, you think, oh dear. But then it's not even like he does some sort of daft scene chewing, which might have actually made it entertaining. He's more just Stephen Berkoff there delivering lines very flatly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stephen Berkoff acting, which is not what you want.
It's to be avoided. It's silly, it's not entertaining, the dialogue's stupid.
It's one of these films where the entire premise of it would fall apart if you'd chosen to sit next to anyone else on the train.
Yeah, it hinges so much on one chance encounter.
It's totally retarded.
Especially when you find out quite what conspires to happen later, which is daft anyway. But then as soon as you find out something, you think back to the style. Well, that was a bit of luck then, wasn't it?
Yes, it is not very good. Don't want.
Moving on to Due Date then, about which I know very little other than it stars Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis. So, Scott, what's it at about?
It takes the formula established by the director, Todd Phillips, who his prior work, The Hangover and Old School, and cranks all of those dials up to about 15, which may be difficult to believe given that neither The Hangover or the Old School were particularly known for the restraint.
Yeah, they're not the most low-key films, are they?
Not in the slightest. We have Robert Downey Jr.'s character Peter trying to get back home to his wife, who is about to have a child, hence the due date of the title. Complications arrive from interactions with Zach Galifianakis. That's close enough. His bafflingly idiotic aspiring actor character, Ethan Tremblay, this sees them booted out the plane, put on a no-fly list, and for a couple of reasons I won't go into, but they wind up having to share a car as they travel across from wherever the hell they are to LA, Hollywood. Yeah, that probably sounds about right. Shenanigans ensue. Now, I like Judy. It's pretty funny. It's definitely funny enough to kind of recommend, especially if you are liking of his previous works, things like The Hangover Old School. It's very much the same thing, but more so. It's possibly almost too much more so. It's definitely cranked up the stupid character immediately doing the single stupidest thing possible in any given situation, all the way up the way. And this has to be the end of this formula. You cannot go further than this. Zach's character is just so bafflingly stupid. It's funny, but it's almost self-parody at this point. And apparently there's going to be a Hangover Part 2 coming up in the next year, maybe 2012, I forget. If they try and do the same thing again, I don't know quite where the end game for this is. This seems like the very logical conclusion of all these kind of this kind of arc of really silly comedies. I don't know where you go from here. Regardless of that, this is quite funny if you can, as long as you don't expect any sort of realism, which I hope you don't, then you'll find this enjoyable enough. Both Downey Jr., Galifianakis, fantastic, charismatic actors, really like them. That's largely where most of this works or fails, because they have quite a good chemistry. It's very funny. Sort of seeing them kind of bounce off each other. Good bit part by Jamie Foxx as well, which kind of helps as well. He's the kind of only real voice of sanity in the whole film. So yes, enjoyable, but I don't know where you're going to take this next. I don't know what the next arc in Todd Phillips' work is going to be, but from what Greg said earlier, I gather this hasn't had a particularly fantastic notices, but I enjoyed this well enough. It's not the best comedy I've seen this year, but it made me laugh for 90-odd minutes, so can't say fairer than that.
There you go. Drew, did you see this one? Did you?
I did, yes.
You did. Drew... Oh, what was? How was I going to word it? I can't remember. Drew, what's your opinion?
almost identical to Scott's. So the point is not anything really added. It's very funny. It's got Rob Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis, who are both very entertaining to watch. And yeah, I think Scott's point about it being like right at the edge of doing the stupidest thing possible right away is spot on, because you couldn't go any further. I think the only way you could be more stupid in those situations would be like that joke about, I think it's an Irishman having one of those Irish people stupid jokes, having walked into his house and found his wife in bed with another man, and pulls out a gun, points at his own head, his wife bursts out laughing, he says, "You shut up, you're next." that's the only level of stupid it could go to after that, and that would be quite a short film if that happened. So it's at the limits, but it's going to stop it being funny.
Extreme comedy, extreme stupidity, extreme Judate. Before we finish, okay, here's my 2 pence worth on Enter the Void. It's not a film for which the word like.
Oh, I thought your sigh was it there.
No, it's not a film for which the word like or dislike is entirely appropriate. To me, it was akin to a massive, massive boxer wrapping his huge fist around a big ball of LSD and punching me so hard in the face that my head came off. That's not necessarily a good thing. It's interesting, as a work, it's interesting, but I don't know what else to say.
I fucking hated Enter the Void. I just dislike Gaspar Noé's stuff in general. I think he's... Mm. Right, I'll put... Like, let's front-load the compliments, right? On a technical level, it's interesting, and there's some really good shots in there. His camera work's, on occasion, very inventive, almost flawless.
Well, most of it's CG, unfortunately, but...
yeah, but I mean, in terms of the way it's composed, I don't think... It's not particularly obvious, see, well...
Yeah, his virtual camera work is fantastic.
Yeah, there's a lot of... On a technical level, there's a lot to appreciate in Enter the Void. Everything else is fucking dire. My main problem...
Are you suggesting that the central performances aren't particularly convincing?
This is my problem with Gaspar Noé. He would not know character or narrative if it came up and staved his face in with a fire extinguisher. He has no taste. I don't know why he's casting these people, because none of them can act. There's some of the most wooden performances I've seen outside of the original wooden puppeteer version of Toy Story. There's nothing good in terms of the acting performances. There's nothing good in terms of the story. It's confused. It doesn't know what it's trying to say. The whole first half hour is basically someone getting stoned and a camera rotating slowly around him while there's some CG kaleidoscope in the background.
Mm-hmm.
this film goes on for, what, 2 hours, 40 minutes?
Yeah, there's various different cuts of it, but yeah, the sort of preferred cut at the moment is 2 hours,
good
40.
Grief. And do you know what it says in that time? Nothing.
Mm.
It's big, soulless, empty nothingness. There's really nothing to take away from this film. And there wasn't within, like, the previous one that he was lauded for was Irreversible, which was basically him putting things backwards and having a couple of moments of shocking violence. And
yeah, it was Memento, but with brutal rape.
The man has no taste. He has a couple of tricks that he likes to use, and that's all he can do. You know, fair play to him. He's coasted by in what I assume must be a relatively comfortable career, because he's still getting people to finance this kind of thing. So he's doing well enough. Fair play to him, but certainly not even close to my cup of tea. There's nothing in here. I don't see what the point of it is. I don't see what it's challenging. I don't see what it's saying. I don't see what points it's making. This whole thing about the Tibetan Book of the Dead does to be sort of shoehorned in as some kind of excuse for what's going on.
That's a complete red herring.
And it's just so clumsy. The whole...
It's not exploring anything at all. I think the problem is...
And it's like, I can do this, so I'm going to do
it. Yeah, well, he could get away with it for as long as he wants, really, because... I think he likes to think, or certainly his idea is to try and convince, and whether he's convinced of himself or whether he's just trying to see how long he can keep fooling people, is that I think he would like to think he's pushing the boundaries of narrative cinema, and he's trying to push the envelope so hard that we have to use something other than an envelope to describe these things anymore. But he pops up once every 4 or 5 years or something. He's almost like Terrence Malick. He pops up once every now and again, but whereas with Terrence Malick, when he sticks his head up, you can be pretty sure that it's going to be something interesting. With Gaspar Noé, I think it's just because if he reared his head any more often than that, people would pretty soon see that the Emperor ain't got no clothes.
Yeah. Exactly.
I honestly don't know. There's nothing to be said about it that hasn't already been said by you, been said by yourself. The acting's absolutely atrocious. This whole pretense at this whole thing of looping and, you know, let's see all the events now, but with the camera bizarrely situated in a sort of third-person viewpoint behind the main character's head and see everything another time. What are you trying to achieve, pal?
If I was summing this up in a word, it'd probably be smug. It seems very, very pleased with itself all the time, for no adequately explained reason.
I feel like I've watched interviews with the guy at press conferences and things like that, and he gets very angry and becomes very petulant and dismisses anyone any time they bring up a question about, you know, why do you feel the need to show scenes, these things? So, I mean, we're talking about a film here that ends on with a cut. I saw, I'm not sure if I saw the same cut as you. It ends on... an operating table with an abortion having just been performed. Does that sound about right to you?
And that actually happens about halfway through, it being the one sort of, oh, look, yeah, I'm controversial moment.
Well, this is the point I'm trying to make, is that any time anyone sort of, do you have to be so graphically sings that he sits and he dismisses it with a sort of very petty line.
You didn't get it.
Well, if you find that controversial, then I'm not sure we are working on the same level and you don't deserve a response from me. It's like, no, if you're going to make a film to be released in cinemas and you expect an audience to sit down and watch it, then I'm sorry, you have to field these questions and you have to give us a legitimate answer. If you're trying to convince us that you were trying to do something, then we want to know the reason why.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have a reason why. I think he just does like to do things for the sake of it, and I think he probably just enjoys the pleasure of watching everybody kick up a stink. And if nobody mentioned the graphic element of his films, the abortion scene and things like that, and, you know, the rape and the let's admit, fairly brutal fire extinguisher scene in Irreversible, then I think he would quite quickly disappear, and I don't think he would get much funding for his films. But so long as people keep sort of putting up with his nonsense, then yeah, he will get funded, because, you know.
There's always the argument that directors shouldn't explain what they're doing. It's the whole reason, I think, Spielberg, who's not done any events, that kind of. But you can't go out of your way to provoke a debate and then say, I'm not debating this, which is what he's trying to get away with. And
yeah.
It just annoys me. It's just not any good. And it's annoying that people seem to think that it's good, because it isn't. I mean, but there's no possible standard you could look at this, or even Irreversible, and say, this is a good film. I just don't see it. It's got a couple of moments of it tries to be very impactful, but that's it. There's nothing else. You could do that in a good film and get away with it, but this just isn't. He annoys me. He pushes all my buttons.
The most interesting thing about anyone given Gaspar Noé film is probably the opening credits. He always does something vaguely hypnotic with his opening credits. And that's all I can think to say. Maybe he should just direct opening credits for films.
Yeah, so if he teamed up with the guy that did the subtitles from Nightwatch, then you know maybe we'll see something good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, certainly interesting, but not necessarily for good reasons.
I'm so angry.
You are so angry right now. You're a hot little potato right now. So that wraps up our first podcast for 2011 then. Yeah, we'll be back soon enough, hopefully. Not least in the form of our year review of 2010, although is that going to be posted before or after this?
I suspect after.
After it is then. Yeah, so hang on in there in the meantime and we will be back soon enough. In the meantime, keep it real. I've been Craig, Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew was Drew, Electric Drew.
Farewell.
See you soon. Bye.